You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 451.
Hello and welcome back to the Outdoors Station on this wet, miserable February day. Unfortunately, I've got to start with an apology. The delay from getting this podcast out from the last one has now been almost 5 weeks. And you can probably hear it in my voice that I'm struggling to say anything without coughing or spluttering, because I too, like most of the UK by the sound of it, have come down with this ridiculous 5 week flu bug, and I'm in the fifth week now, and it's almost gone, but if I'm not careful, I start a coughing fit and I can't stop. So that's my excuse for not releasing anything in the last few weeks, and I do apologise. And the interviews that I had lined up, I had to cancel, unfortunately, for obvious reasons. However, I have spent some of the time in negotiation with some new interviewees, one of which is Keith Foskett, regarding his forthcoming book, High and Low. I'm really looking forward to speaking once again with Keith and finding out more about the book. And I know the gist of the story is following his highs and lows, both physically and emotionally, as he walks around Scotland, starting on the Cape Wrath Trail. So to remind myself of what the Cape Wrath Trail was like, I actually dug out of the archives the five-part series that I recorded back, would you believe, in 2008, where I took to the Cape Wrath Trail with Lee Wells. I joined him at Ullapool and we made our way up to Cape Wrath. And I actually really enjoyed listening to them again, but it's hard to believe it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago in May this year. Ironically, what's happened this year is that Rose and I are aiming to do the Sky Trail before she returns and I continue on the TGO, which is exactly what Lee was doing 10 years ago. He was doing the Cape Wrath Trail and then went on to the TGO Challenge. And I think he had an exceptionally good crossing from what I remember. Glorious weather, and of course he was as fit as a fiddle before he started, so he had a great time. So, coming back to the Cape Wrath Trail series, I thought I would re-release this five-part series, and hopefully by the time we get to the end of it, I will have fully recovered and be back on form. I'm going to release them fairly swiftly, so only a few days gap between them, in the hope that you'll forgive me for the next podcast from the Outdoor Station. Now that it's 2018 and we are all older and wiser and more experienced with a lot of equipment, and equipment of course has developed and moved on, fabrics have changed, designs have moved on, it's interesting to hear what we discuss during this series and actually make note of what has changed and what hasn't changed. So in this part, part one, I mentioned the GoLite Shangri-La 3. Now that has now, well, GoLite ceased to exist 5 years ago, I think. And so there is a very similar design to the Shangri-La 3, which is now the Nigor Wiki Up 3. And so, of course, some of the comments I make refer to a tent which is no longer in production. Lee used the Gossamer Gear Mariposa Plus, which he refers to in this podcast. Now, Gossamer Gear is still going, and so is the Mariposa, and however, now it is made in aerobic fabric. And the product that Lee is referring to is made from Ripstop Nylon. I think it was their version 1 or version 2 of the very popular Mariposa. In fact, if you look on the website, you will see some pictures, I'm sure, over the next five-part series where you actually see him wearing his rucksack. And I know that he had best part of 10 years use out of it. And he was always really, really pleased with the rucksack. And certainly, as you'll hear him explain, it saved him almost 2 kilos on his previous rucksack, which was incredible. The other item that I mentioned in part one is the Paramo Velez or Velez smock, which I purchased literally on the first day just to test it out because I'd not used Paramo before. And I found it to be very comfortable, very quiet material. And of course, the product is still made. But at the end of this trip, I think I make the observation that I find Paramo too warm. And so a few occasions where the sun came out, it was actually too warm for me. So I stripped back to my normal windshirt. So anyway, I think I will now pass over to part one of the five-part series from the Cape Wrath Trail, going back to the dizzy time of 2008 as I walk across the beach at Ullapool and introduce where we are and let the trip unfold before you.
Listening to theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
Hello, welcome to another, hopefully, new series of travelling podcasts up here in Scotland. I'm up in Ullapool at the moment. It's literally the last couple of days of April, going into May. And I'm in the campsite at Ullapool, the Broomhall campsite, which is right on the shores of Loch Broom. As you can hear, I'm on a stony shore at the moment. And for the end of April day, there's a slight breeze, but being very, very fortunate, the gods have shined on me once again. And I'm blinking in the sunshine and can hardly see a cloud in the sky, although the weather forecast tells us that that is a figment of our imagination and will be changing shortly. So what am I doing? Well, I'm doing part of the Cape Wrath Trail with Lee Wells, a buddy of mine, which regular listeners will know. I made friends with initially several years ago in the TGO Challenge, and we've kept in contact ever since, trying to do a bit of a walk each year. And Lee's going on to do the TGO Challenge after this walk. And it's a bit of a warm-up for him, also extending his holiday break, and also enables me to get away from the office for a few days, about a week, I think, I'm planning to be away, and enjoy Scotland at its best, which is, if the weather keeps like this, will be absolutely fabulous. Glorious weather if we can. Yeah, I'm expecting a bit of rain and obviously a bit cool, but if it keeps like this, we'll be more than happy. So from Ullapool, we're heading due east past Loch Achill, if I've got that name correct for the Scots listeners, up Glen Achill to, let's have a look, Dag Bridge by the woods there. And we're camping tonight, or being well, by the side of the river where the confluence joins there between the two of the rivers are coming down. We're taking it fairly easily. This isn't a sort of a long-distance challenge. This is hopefully 6-7 days walking the 90-odd miles up to Cape Wrath, past the Sandwood Bay, which we're very much looking forward to. In fact, we're walking up past it and then coming back down again before we pick the bus up back to Inverness and I head home and Lee starts the challenge. So hopefully, once again, this will lead to a range of conversations and chats with various people we meet en route. Obviously, if there are various holidaymakers here, I mean, the campsite has probably got a good couple of dozen campervans and caravans on there, of mainly of Dutch descent by the looks of the number plates. And what a fine spot it is today. The water is literally a mill pond. It's one of those days where I wish I had a kayak, a Canadian canoe or a sea kayak, and I could just potter out and go and do a bit of fishing. But we hope to do a bit of that as we go along. Anyway, so I'm going to stop this now and go and collect Lee from the campsite, find out where we're going today, and gently get into it. But looking forward to a gentle stroll, and we'll have a chat with you as we go along. As always, I'm trying out new bits of equipment or equipment that's just been released, such as the GoLite Shangri-La 3, which is my tent of choice this time. And I've got the new GoLite Adrenaline 20 sleeping bag of my my sleeping system. But I'll go through the rest of the list of the gear and so on as time allows, and explain what I'm doing and how I'm doing it as each day goes by. So if you're sitting back and listening to this, hopefully we'll have a bit of useful information if you're ever considering doing this trail, which I'm told by numerous people is one of the most beautiful trails in Scotland. And also, if you're sitting in the office or whatever, seeking some escapism, I'll try and describe my surroundings and the landscape as best I can. So I'll catch up with you soon.
On the 13th of June, 1788, the good ship Gil Morton sailed into Loch Broom with 55 passengers, one blacksmith, one cooper, one fish curer, one heckler, two joiners, seven masons, one net maker, one slater, and their families. These artisans were to build streets, houses, and shops, the nucleus of a new village. Problems developed with the foundations of the pier in 1790, but rescue was at hand. Engineer Thomas Telford, no less, was appointed surveyor of buildings and became responsible for much of Ullapool's grid layout and architecture. In 1880, Ullapool fell on evil times with a rapid decline in the herring industry. The local economy faced virtual collapse. Only the budding tourist industry, with visitors travelling by coach from Strathpeffer on the east coast and by steamer from Glasgow, provided the village with hope for the future. Nowadays, Ullapool thrives on a combination of fishing, lobsters and prawns, servicing the ferry to Stornoway on the Outer Hebrides and tourism. It has boat cruises, a pipe band, a leisure centre, a swimming pool, a wildlife hospital, an angling club, sites of archaeological interest, including a prehistoric settlement, a museum with visitor centre and tourist information centre. It also has a clock, some Klondikers and a community radio station. Fishing has played an important role in the economy of the village for 200 years, but with alternating periods of glut and dearth. When herring was plentiful, the industry prospered. When herring failed, the industry fell into decline, and the villagers had to look elsewhere for an income. After World War II, fishing techniques improved through technological change and the increased size of boats. But again, the boom did not last. In the late 60s, the low-draft Scandinavian Klondikers appeared in Loch Broom, so called after the enormous influx of treasure hunters to the Klondike in 1896. The treasure this time was herring. They employed local men to freeze the fish caught by East Coast boats. The fish was then taken to ports around the world. Herring again declined in 1975, but news of the nutritional value of mackerel brought them to the fore. The Klondikers struck again. Loch Broom was filled with anything up to 70 Eastern Bloc factory ships. Sometimes Nigerian, Irish, French and even Japanese Klondikers also swelled the numbers of ships at anchor. Ullapool prospered again, busy by day and magical at night, with the dipping, bobbing masthead and working lights and their shimmering reflections. Today, the appearance of the floating factories is sporadic, and Ullapool's fishing fleet now numbers only about a dozen boats. If you visit Ullapool, we are sure that you will enjoy the experience. But all good things must come to an end. It is now time to depart, so pack your rucksack and stride out ever northwards. The Cape beckons you.
Well, good morning. The start of day two. And why didn't I do anything else during day one? Well, it's quite simple, really. The day started off unbelievably. Picture postcard, blue skies, glorious sunshine, a cool breeze, but it was just wonderful, so much so that Lee and I lazed around in our tents longer than we originally intended and eventually dragged ourselves out of the campsite about 9:30, 10 o'clock-ish, which wasn't quite the early start that we'd sort of initially anticipated. But when those moments happen, you tend to sort of try and make the most of them. And we got 100 yards up the road into the first outdoor shop, as you do. Most people who are into the outdoors will know you never pass a kit shop without just having a check, just to see if they've got any bargains. And sure enough, they'd got something that I'd been curious about trying for this trip and never got round to buying because I didn't have anyone that stocked it near me. And that was some Paramo, a Paramo Valise smock. So I succumbed. I got the plastic out and got myself a Paramo Valise smock. And I thought, well, it'll be a good test, really, to see if they're as good and flexible as people say they are, being a sort of smock that you can wear virtually all the time, obviously windproof, but completely waterproof as well, due to the push-pull system and so on of the material. So, with my new purchase, we headed out of town, and we started to get up to Loch Dumph, heading east. And within about, an hour, 2 hours, the rain started. And it was, for people in Scotland who have been, they'll know, it's that in-your-face, with the wind, continual, doesn't let up, just a steady, starts as a steady drizzle, and then just gets into a steady pour of rain. And that pretty well kept up for the rest of the day. We did, when we finally got to our camping spot, once we passed the Bothy, we kept going for a bit more, past another lock, and we come down to a confluence now of the rivers. Lee clocked it that we did 27 kilometres yesterday. And I must admit, I hadn't realised I hadn't been out and done any great distances for a while, because when we eventually got here, I was shattered. Absolutely shattered. So I was really, really grateful for put the tent up, get the food on, crawl into my sleeping bag and enjoy a meal and just slowly get myself together. But I'm sure you're asking, how did the smock turn out? Well, I'm very, very impressed. All I wore was a long sleeve Montane base layer. And this Valise smock, expecting to change at some stage during the day. But I didn't need to. It kept me beautifully insulated in the sense that I was warm without being sweaty. And it certainly did bead the water. The water came pouring down from every area of the sky. And there wasn't the slightest bit of problems. In fact, Lee was quite envious of my newfound purchase. Because he was forever sort of stopping and starting and pulling hoods up and so on with his normal waterproofs. So day one, the Valise smock passed the test, and it's a very comfortable, very quiet material. So any more comments on that, I shall bring it forward. But certainly very, very impressed, and certainly glad I bought it. I've already got the waterproofs and stuff with me, but I wanted to try something a bit different if I could, just to talk about on this trip. Getting to the camping area was pretty hard. Lee and I again were talking that, Lee and I were saying on the way that you look at the map in Scotland and you see the contours change and level out down towards a river, and you think, oh, that'll be a lovely spot, should be just right, we'll see the morning sun or the evening sun, whatever it might be, but chances are when you get there it's boggy, or if it's not boggy it's very tussocky, or it's full of stones and rocks that have been brought down over the years down the stream and so on and spread around the area, and it's very, very hard to find a nice levelish short grass area which is big enough for a couple of tents in this such a large area. So, but we managed to find a spot. We had to do a few extra miles to do it because the initial places at the end of the lochs there we thought would be ideal certainly weren't. And we also would read somewhere that if you didn't cross that river, if it was in spate during the night, then you might have a difficulty crossing it. So we carried on and, as I say, camped now by the confluence. Now, the Shangri-La, which I'm using, is copious. It's a huge amount of space for one person. And just to let you know what I've done a slight bit of adaptation on it. It comes with the standard six pegs. Well, I've got rid of those and changed them for titanium pegs, which are much easier on the hands to put in and also grip better. And that's one thing. Then there are six other little loops around the panels, which are there for adaptation, I guess. So I've put a short piece of shock cord through each one, and I've added another six of the titanium thin pegs. The main ones being the titanium V pegs I exchanged. So these ones are the six thin pegs, or five rather, and the spare peg is for holding the door open Now, the door, thankfully, has been altered from the hex, and they've got an additional adjustable tab on the door, which means now that you can actually open the door as far as you like, put the tab over the top of a spike of an inverted pole, or a couple of poles, and then with a bit of shock cord, guy cord, a Dyneema in my case, a 1.5mm Dyneema, you can peg it out, and you get yourself a nice big windbreak, as well as protection for the door area, to do some cooking under. And talking of which, the other bit of adaptation I've done is... I must mention this. I spoke to somebody the other day. The new poles on the Shangri-La are different from the old ones. I don't really like them. I must admit, they've got these this sprung-loaded popper that goes up in sections of about a couple of inch each section. And naturally, it's very, very difficult to, in a wind and the rain, like it was last night, you can't be bothered with faffing about with trying to get it into the particular section. But you have to for the pole to obviously stay clicked in place and erect. And I was speaking to somebody before I came away who was saying that they were having a problem during the winter period of the pole sinking into the ground, which is understandable because you put the pole up, you pull down the tension, the wind and rain batters the tent during the night, and sure enough, the pole will sink into the ground a bit, which of course then in turn makes the sides flappy. I suggested just very, very quickly, because I used to ride a motorbike, a motorbike side stand support. These are little, usually round or slightly oblong plastic hard discs, which have a cup on one side where the motorbike side stand sits in, and on the base is usually indentations, a rough area, so the bike doesn't sink into warm tarmac. So I happened to mention this to this person I was chatting to, and I forgot to get one myself before I came away. And while we were at the campsite, I said to the warden there, I said, is there a bike shop in town? And I explained what I was after. And he said, interesting you should say that. I've got a handful of these. People keep leaving them from the campsite. So lo and behold, I got myself a side stand protector, or whatever you want to call it, plate, I think they're called. And put it underneath the pole. Fantastic. The pole hasn't sunk last night at all. It did the previous night, but this night's fantastic. So that's a good bit of advice for people. Only a couple of quid, I think, from a motorbike shop. The other bit of adaptation I've done, the night before I came away, I took my scissors and sewing machine to the ground sheet. I've got a full-sized ground sheet in here, the proper one that goes with the Shangri-La. And if you like, I cut a line from where the door zip goes down to about a foot away from the centre pole. I'm looking at it at the moment, I'm trying to find the words to describe it. Down to the centre pole. And I've bound it. That's put a little binding around the edge of the cut to make sure it doesn't fray and fall apart and so on. And what this means is The ground sheet can be a full ground sheet. In other words, the cut edge can go up to the corner. I put a tab on it as well, so it all ties together. But when you want to do some cooking, or when you want to come in and out of the tent in conditions like you can hear now, rain, you can actually pull this little wedge of cheese, if you like, shape away from the doorway, and you've got the grass area that you can cook on, and obviously put your burner on and so on. As well as get in and out of the tent without bringing mud into the ground sheet, which is one of the biggest complaints about any sort of pyramid tent, really. If the ground sheet is complete and goes right to the doorway, every time you come in and go out, you're forever bringing in mud. So I've done that, and it's proved to be a fantastic success. It's just great. You just the other night, last night, but the night before, when I first met up with Lee, we were both sitting in the tent doorway, as it were, pulled back the floor, cooked on the floor a bit, and did a brew while we were chatting, staring out at the sunshine. It was wonderful. And then pushed it back when I went to sleep. And the same last night as well. I just couldn't be bothered moving. I didn't have the energy, so I just managed to roll over, do what I had to do, and then push the ground sheet back. So if anyone is any good with a sewing machine and has confidence to cut up Shangri-La ground sheet, then I would thoroughly recommend that as a nice little addition to the normal working system. So that's my little bit of advantage. I'll talk about some other bits and bobs of kit in a while, but I think I've probably done enough at the moment. So As you can hear, the wind's picking up again. A bit more of the Scottish mist is hitting the outside of the tent. I understand from Lee we're going past a hotel or possibly a little village this morning. So we might stop for a brew or a cup of coffee or a beer or whatever, depending what time we go past there. Once we get settled up and packed up, I'm going to ask Lee exactly where we're going today. And that pretty well wrapped up yesterday, and we're now looking forward to starting the day today. And it's 8:30, so we're both slowly coming to and enjoying our coffee. So I'll speak to you later. Well, we've decamped now, and we're just about to hump the rucksacks on. And Lee's sitting here, or standing here with me, dressed in waterproofs. Of course, I've got my new Valise smock on, which is very comfortable and very nice. And are we looking at grey skies again, Lee?
Yes, I'm afraid so, Bob, but there's a little bit of sun in the horizon.
And bursting through occasionally. It was a bit disappointing yesterday, wasn't it?
Rather wet, yeah, to say the least.
It was a good sort of five and a half hours worth of wet trudge.
Yeah, a good hard day. Yeah, just what you need.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going past a hotel, I understand, this morning. What, in a couple of hours' time, do you reckon?
Yes, the Oracle Bridge Hotel, yeah. About 5K down the track.
Yeah, get a bit of breakfast there or something, do you think?
Yeah, and some liquid refreshment, hopefully.
Okay, excellent. And then how far we got to go today and where we're going to end up, do you think?
Possibly about 20K and end up at Loch Alsh, if we can find somewhere to pitch.
Excellent. Good. Okay, we'll look forward to that. And when we were on established tracks all the way, really, aren't we? Sort of a Land Rover track or even a metalled road in some places.
Yeah, it's all good tracks today all the time, yeah. The Cape Wrath Trails, most of it is on good tracks, to be honest.
Is it?
Yeah.
I know yesterday when we came past the Bothy, there's a crew from the Mountain Bothers Association working in there. And they were doing a grand job of replacing some of the glass and stuff, and it was nice to sit down for 5 or 10 minutes and dry out and steam in front of that fire they had going.
Yes, as a member of the MBA myself, I thoroughly enjoyed it, watching my party fix the bothy.
Yeah, it's a shame you didn't stay there, it would have been warm.
Yes, it would have been nice, wouldn't it, but there you go.
I think we would have ended up being labourers though if we'd stayed.
Yeah, it's easier to put the tent up in the rain, I think, than stay there glazing.
Brilliant, and how are you pleased? You've got your new pack now, that's the first time I've seen you use it. You pleased with that?
Very pleased, yeah, it's one of the most comfortable packs I've worn.
Which one is it now?
It's a Gossamer Gear Mariposa Plus.
Yeah. And see, that was the one that Colin was using last year,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, Colin using it last year, yes, but without the hip belt he didn't. But yeah. I'm fully loaded with the hip belt and the sponge in the pads, and it works very well.
Oh, good. Excellent. Well, hopefully we'll touch base and have another chat as we go through the day and have a bit more to talk about. But at the moment, as I say, the cloud level's down fairly low. It's fairly grey and dark. Being Scotland, anything can happen in the next half hour.
Certainly can, and it will.
Yeah.
It will.
You plan for the worst, hope for the best.
Yes, that's it, but hopefully the Valise will hold up just for today. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, it did a grand job yesterday, so we'll get down to the hotel and I'll have a coffee or something else when we get there.
Yeah, find a bitter. Can't wait.
Lovely. After a couple of hours, we made it down to the Oracle Bridge Hotel, which was, very nice, but very quiet. There's only us there, but we had a swift half and a couple of bacon sandwiches to fortify us for the day. And we met another couple of walkers that were starting the Cape Wrath, as it happens, from the hotel. So they'll be following in our footsteps tomorrow. One thing I did want to ask Lee about as we wander down this path while it isn't raining is how he came by the actual route that we're actually taking today.
I came across a book called the Cape Wrath Trail, Cicerone Press, yeah. I think found it in a bookshelf and it just really appealed to me.
Because I'm entirely in your hands on this trail, where we're starting and stopping and the route we're taking, so How would you describe it? How does it come across? Is it a fairly remote trail or is it fairly sociable?
Fairly remote, I think. I don't think we'll be coming across too many walkers, but I think there is, as the landlady of the hotel said, she gets one or two walkers in every week doing the trail. So it's not a West Island way, but not quite so sociable as that. But There is people doing it out there, yes.
So it sounds like the Green Pound is made its way to this part of the world, the same as everywhere else. It was also quite interesting with the current topic at the moment of the fuel or potential fuel crisis, certainly fuel increases, just how much impact it makes into rural communities this far away from the mainland fuel supplies.
Well, that's right. And as the landlady said, you know, she's probably a little bit worried about it, yeah.
She was certainly implying that the fishermen would... they've got a coach load or a batch of fishermen at the moment, she was saying, but they were certainly quite concerned that it's been a slow start this season.
Yes, that's right, because people rely heavily on obviously the cars to reach one point to the next, so much distance in between.
Yeah, well, the coaches and so on. So, Lee, you've really done quite a few of the glens and the walks in Scotland, and you sort of only really taken to it over the last few, what, last 5-10 years?
Yes, but probably about 11-12 years, yeah.
And so what did you first do? How did you first get into it?
I think my first taste of Scotland was a family holiday when I walked up Ben Nevis on the last day when the cloud lifted and met two chaps that had walked the West Island Way, and chatting to them about it, and it sort of conjured up all things in my imagination. And the following year, I did the West Island Way.
And you did that on your own?
Did that on my own, yes.
Yeah. And so what sort of gear, what sort of things were you using first time you did that? How many years ago now?
11 years ago.
11 years, yeah.
Heavy, I suppose, is the answer. Carrymore rucksack, a synthetic sleeping bag, and heavy waterproofs. But they got me through, yeah.
Yeah, was it tough going? Do you look back at it and think it was actually much harder going than you expected?
It was actually. It was harder than I expected it would be, yes, it was. But I did actually pull a muscle in my leg on the last 10 miles, but I hobbled in.
Excellent. Over the last few years, you sort of, obviously, as the lightweight ethos has been upon us and being promoted, you've taken that on board, but you slowly worked through a whole range of equipment to the gear that you're currently carrying now before you actually take the same equipment on the TGO Challenge. And have you found it a natural progression and fairly easy? Has it been a sort of a change of mindset more than actually spending lots of money?
Yeah, I think both are equal, really, spending money and the mindset. I suppose it's my hobby as well, you know, I love gear. It's part of my hobby, and I don't mind spending a bit of cash there, but I enjoy looking at new stuff and taking on board this lightweight philosophy. Yeah.
What's been your biggest jump, do you think?
It's got to be this Gossamer Gear rucksack that I'm carrying now. It's, you know, 2 kilos probably lighter than my Jaguar.
You did 10 to 11 years ago?
Yes, I did 11, yeah. In between, yeah. I had the Osprey Ether that I stripped down to 1.8, which was lovely, comfortable, roomy sack. But so is this, though. So I've saved a kilo there with any, no loss of comfort.
I mean, and I've been walking with you now for, 4 years or so, and I think when I first met you, you had quite a winter, thick winter sleeping bag, which has obviously kept you warm, because I know you're a cold sleeper, but you've changed that quite now, haven't you?
Yes, I used to bring the Mount Equipment Snowline, which was... it was about 1.5 or something like that, which is really comfortable, but obviously took a lot of room in a rucksack. So this year I've gone for a Marmot Helium, which is only 800, and equipped with my cocoon insulated trousers and my down jacket, I think we'll cope with any cold weather that Scotland's going to chuck at me this month.
So you've obviously got two uses out of the gear now. You've actually downrated the sleeping bag, but your sort of tent gear has been a lot more comfortable and more insulated, and you just stay wearing the same clothes as you get into the sleeping bag.
That's right, yeah, and I think that's the lightweight philosophy, is trying to, you know, deal with use for as much equipment as possible.
I see we're coming to a herd of Highland Coos right in front of us, so we'll have to wander through those. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was food, because everybody has a different approach to food. There are people that refer to
spend their money, have a green pound, as it were, and spend locally, which is to be respected and obviously keeps the communities going. And then there are people like myself hang on a second, I've got to get through this, this area where the cows have been, full of cow stuff. Oh, lovely. Lots and lots of mud. I think we need to go around there, don't we? All right, I'm going to pause this for a second. So we've just come out of the farmyard there, or at least where the cows were gathered to be fed, and sadly had to wade through a certain amount of cow dew and assorted mud. And my Rock Lights 315s have coped admirably well, but I've just stood in a stream to clean them off and obviously reduce the smell factor tonight, which would probably emanate from them in the tent. Now, before we got to the cows there, we were talking about food and the fact that we're the sort of people that we cook and dry our own meals. But you use a particular brand that you've used for the last few years, and I see you're still happy with it.
Yes, I use Be Well products. They're going in that pack and go, it's called. And you get a breakfast, a cereal bar for lunchtime, and a sports drink, beef fuel, and then your main meal, which is, there's seven varieties, and a dessert, and that sort of lasts you all day with a few added things like soup. I add soup, and we also get a hot chocolate drink with it as well.
But I mean, for value for money, you get quite a lot of calories there, and it's not that bulky or heavy an item, is it?
No, it's only about 700 grams, and if you buy seven, I think you got seven for £45, which is not bad.
So that's 7 days worth of food?
Yes, seven packs, yes, 7 days worth.
Yeah, well, food is an expensive item. It's also a heavy item, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it can soon add up, food days, yeah, soon add up.
I mean, I've come on this trip now, and I think I've got below 10k as my base weight, but as soon as I put the 2k of food in for the next couple of days, or a bit longer than that perhaps, it's the things like the chocolate bars and all the sweets and the treats that seem to pile on the weight.
Well, that's it, yeah, on the weight, on your back and on your stomach as well. But the key to it, as we're both doing, is to send parcels on and pick them up as you go along. And I do that on the TGO challenges, as well as we're doing on this trip as well, both of us.
Have you ever come across anybody that's sort of tried more of a bushcraft approach and actually living off the land as such?
No, I can't say I have, no. I think you're with your bush buddy, and Colin is on the TGO challenge, is probably the nearest I've come to it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking for things to eat that, in my limited knowledge, that I picked up from Nomad Bushcraft, that course I went on a few weeks ago. And certainly there ain't an awful lot up here in this terrain. I mean, we've certainly had primroses and primrose leaves you can eat, and dandelion leaves. But beyond that, there's been very little sort of local food, as it were, grown food, that one could use. I mean, certainly the rivers offer the potential of fish, although obviously you need to have the appropriate permissions and licences and so on. And then the other side of it is rabbits, but I've actually not seen any sign of rabbits.
No, I've seen very little wildlife, to be honest, of any variety. Only obviously deer, a few little birds tweeting here and there, but yeah. No eagles. I did on my first day see a bird of prey, but being not very good in that area, I don't honestly know what it was.
Well, this morning we heard cuckoos, and I heard my first skylark of the year, which was a lovely sound. Sadly, it had gone before I turned the recorder on. But beyond that, it's not the sort of place you could actually, I think, live off the land. And it does make you wonder about some of these people that used to live up here years ago. I gather in one of your previous walks, you came across somebody that said that they'd lived in a bother you'd passed.
Yes, I was walking near Caror Station, and I met an elderly chap walking towards me and stopped and asked where I'd been, and I said I'd just camped in the glen, and said not in the bothy, and I said no, not in the bothy, because I used to live in that bothy 25 years ago when I was a shepherd and gamekeeper for the estate, and I thought it was quite fascinating.
It must have been a tough lifestyle though, don't you think?
It would be where he was, and because he did say that some occasions he was snowed in for at least a week at a time.
Remarkable. Well, as you can hear, we're crossing over a stream. The route that we're walking on is, well, would appear to be pretty well so far, sort of Land Rover tracks of different varieties of quality, so you can certainly get a good pace on. This is quite a well uh, a well-covered track. Weather, once again, is changeable. We've got black clouds behind us and sort of blue sky, a little bit of blue sky ahead of us, so we're hoping that the weather will hold tonight before we find our camping spot. We have been told by numerous people, in fact, a couple of people we met in the hotel there were doing the trail, and they were Scots folk, and they were sort of telling us a bit more about what to expect in the area, and it sounds like it's going to be a fairly unique landscape that we're going to be going through.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think it's a very, very changeable landscape, and I've not been this far north myself, and sort of really looking forward to the change, you know, the changeable mountains and all the scenery that has to offer.
Excellent. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed the weather holds. Anyway, we'll draw a line under it now, and we'll come back and have a bit more of a chat later on.
Thanks for joining us on this part of the trip. Excerpts were read from the Cicerone Guide North to the Cape, which is available from cicerone.co.uk. Join us next time as we move closer to our goal, walking through some of the most spectacular and remote scenery in the UK on the Cape Wrath Trail.
This independent programme has been brought to you by The Outdoor Station.co.uk.